You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, you might not know it when you look at the surface of a local lake, but there are a lot of random things strewn around the bottom of those bodies of water. Think cars or gas grills. We'll talk to a maritime archaeologist who's been examining what's at the bottom of our lakes. Now, over the past few months, we've been looking at the issue of student turnover and how it affects the learning environment in many ways. Those conversations have been based on a series by Erin Richards. She's an education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Today, we're looking at an innovative nonprofit project in New Orleans, which provides support and information to parents to help reduce student turnover. Ramesha Johnson works as a personal education advisor with the Ed Navigator program in New Orleans. Ramesha, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And Erin, great to have you back on Central Time.
It's great to be back.
Erin, before we get started, you wrote a multi-part series for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about high student turnover. Can you remind us a little bit of what you found about the impact on students and on schools?
Yep. So we looked statewide and nationwide about the issue of student turnover in schools. And what we found in statewide in Wisconsin, about 1 in 10 kids change schools in ways that are not planned, right? Like, we expect kids to go from a sixth grade at an elementary school, if that's the top grade in the school, to then change schools to a middle school. What we were trying to isolate were changes that kids make that are out of order, or they're not an expected transition. So when we isolated for those, we found about 1 in 10 kids in Wisconsin change schools in ways that are not planned. And then in Milwaukee, the rate was much higher. So about 1 in 4 kids in Milwaukee across all publicly funded schools are not staying with the same school all year. On top of that, we know that some schools are way more affected by turnover than others. So in Milwaukee, we found some schools with 30, 40, even 50% turnover. And we connected that to the fact that it's really tough for those schools to make strong connections with kids and families. And it's really hard to show growth, achievement growth over time when so many kids are moving in and out of your building.
So, Erin, in this latest article, you look at the nonprofit Ed Navigator program in New Orleans. How did that pop up on your radar?
I had gone to New Orleans to actually explore the city's unified enrollment system. Ramesha would be able to talk about this much more elegantly, but essentially, New Orleans is a city full of school choice. Almost every school is a charter school, and so parents have to make an active choice in where they're going to go. I wanted to know more about how the city, about 13 years after the hurricane, had come to be using a system where all schools, public, private, choice schools, were essentially playing in the same sandbox and having parents all go to one place to enroll in schools. While I was researching that story, I was talking to a researcher at Tulane University, and he was talking about, you know, a lot of transferring kids and a lot of kids leaving schools in the middle of the year to go elsewhere. And I said, isn't there anything that's helping to mitigate this? Is there any program or anything new coming up? And he said, well, actually, there is. There's a service. It's a nonprofit. It's pretty new. And it connects parents with personal education advisors to help figure out what schools are good fits for their kids, how to stay with schools, how to navigate all those challenges between what the school wants and what the parent wants for their child. And so we spent a few days down in New Orleans in January of 2018, just before Mardi Gras, following people like Ramesha and Gary Briggs around as they did their work, going into businesses and connecting with workers at those businesses to talk with them about their kids in schools and what they needed to be successful.
And Ramesha, before we get to your role as a personal education advisor with Ed Navigator, you are also a parent. And I wanted to talk with you first about what are the challenges that you see for yourself and for other parents in navigating the school system, the education system in New Orleans?
So I have a beautiful 11-year-old daughter, and I am taking care of an 8-year-old family member. When my daughter entered school, it was before the One App started. So that's the centralized enrollment process. And when I was trying to pick a school for her then, I had to complete several applications. I had to submit all of my personal documentation. And it took a lot of running around to different schools to then submit those applications in person. So she got into an elementary school that was directly run by the Orleans Charter School Board, and she was there for pretty much from pre-K until the fifth grade. one of the challenges we have in the city of New Orleans is that, of course, the district is very decentralized in that there are a number of different charter management organizations that are educating our students. And prior to charters really existing here, we had a lot of trust in the current district. I'm a school counselor by trade, even though my concentration was more with high school students. So one of the challenges that I had as a parent personally is that when you're an educator who's also a parent, there's this sense of, like, blanket understanding. Like, I was supposed to understand, like, the challenges that the school had and was supposed to be okay with that, when in actuality, I understood what the challenges were probably more deeply than any of the other parents in the school. And I tried to work very hard to partner with my child's school and to help them understand, like, yes, I know what the challenges are. I want you to do something about them, too. So last school year, we had found out the year prior that the school was going to be closed for financial and sustainability reasons. So I was in the process now of having to actually enter the centralized enrollment process. One of the unique things about me personally is that I have worked at a charter management network. I've worked at the recovery district for a little while. Again, I'm an educator parent. So I've been able, and also working at a navigator, I've been able to see, like, kind of the behind the scenes of almost all of the schools in the city. And I was just so frustrated and dismayed because, you know, I did not know where I even wanted to send my child. But long story short, we found a school that we are currently pretty happy with. There are some hiccups here and there. But if I, as an educator who has insider knowledge about schools, have difficulties, just imagine how difficult it is for the average parent here in the city.
We're talking with Ramesha Johnson. She works as a personal education advisor with Ed Navigator, a nonprofit in New Orleans. And Erin Richards is with us as well. She's an education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who's been looking at the issue of student turnover. And Ramesha, so as a personal education advisor with Ed Navigator, what do you do specifically for families that you're working with?
We are connected with employees through the employee partnerships that we've established. I'm here in the city, and we help them with an assortment of things. School choice, of course, is one of them. We also take a lot of time to help parents understand how their children are actually doing. When you think about the opportunities that parents get to connect with teachers, it's really either centered around, like, report card conferences, which last maybe 5 or 10 minutes, or, like, when teachers are, like, updating parents about, like, behavior or maybe some wins a student has had. But underneath all of that, there's lots of things that are happening within a school. So they are testing kids fairly regularly. There are state tests that are done annually. And so what we do is we, with parents' permission, request access to the student records, and then we analyze that information. So anything that we get on a student, be it report card, attendance data, test data, teacher anecdotes, you name it, we synthesize that data and we come back to a parent and we share with them, like, how we perceive their students are actually doing. And from there, we set goals. So that's the bulk of our work. And we spend time throughout the year making touch points that are specific to what we call seasons. So there's, like, school choice season. There's summer camp finding season. There's the time when we are supporting families with summer learning loss, so that they don't lose those critical skills when they're on break. We've also helped families acting as liaisons, because our parents work most hours that coincide with the school day. So we have helped coordinate meetings for them or attended report card conferences. Basically, anything a parent has asked us to do, if we are able to do it, we support them.
And Ramesha, my understanding from reading Erin's article is that businesses pay Ed Navigator to come in and meet with their employees to offer this service, you know, as kind of a bonus as part of their employment. Is it also available to people who are not working for, say, one of these big hotel chains that's a partner with Ed Navigator?
Yes, actually, we do have on our website the option for folks who want to pay directly to us. We have a small handful of folks that have opted to subscribe to our services that way. Also, We have had energy provider grants to Liberty's Kitchen here in the city, which is a program that works with what we call opportunity youth to get them skills in the hospitality industry. And the way that is set up for us is we get to meet with those students in that program to help them decide what their next options are. So they're getting workforce training, but some students also either want to go back to finish their high school career or they want to pursue further education. And so we consult with them while they're in that program.
And Erin, as we wrap up, is this a model that you could see working in Milwaukee?
I think that the model to provide parents with much more support within a system of choice where quality is often predicated on you picking good options or higher quality options for your kids is really something that not just Milwaukee, but other cities could be looking into. We've seen the expansion of all kinds of different options for people to attend public schools and schools with other taxpayer dollars, but we haven't seen the same infrastructure rise up to help parents make those choices in the middle. And we have a lot of evidence that shows that just choice alone hasn't raised the quality of all schools. And so what we found exciting about this model in our reporting is that it did seem to be something that could be sustainable over time. It involves businesses in sort of a unique way. And it is trying to place people like Ramisha with a lot of knowledge of education systems and background in positions to help parents that don't have the same kind of knowledge. And I think that that's a really worthy effort.
Well, Erin, thanks so much for bringing us up to speed on the topic.
Thanks.
And Ramisha, thanks so much for joining us and sharing your experiences.
Thank you also.
Ramisha Johnson works as a personal education advisor with the Ed Navigator program in New Orleans, and Erin Richards is an education reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They joined us to talk about how Ed Navigator works to reduce student turnover and whether it could have applications in Wisconsin.
Coming up, there are a lot of interesting and unexpected items on the bottom of the Yahara Lakes. We'll talk to a maritime archaeologist after the break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a city planner about how communities can make themselves more walkable.
First, you've probably heard of shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, but imagine for a moment more mundane finds like lawnmowers, barbecue grills, maybe even some cars scattered on the bottom of Wisconsin lakes like Lake Mendota in Madison.
There's a lot of stuff on the bottom of these smaller lakes, and we can learn a lot about ourselves from what's down there.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society's Maritime Preservation and Archaeology Program. Tamara, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tell us a little bit about maritime archaeology. What does that mean?
Well, mostly I work on shipwrecks of the state. So we have more than 750 shipwrecks that were lost in state water, state bottomlands. And we go out and do about 3 to 5 surveys a summer where we do what's called phase two archaeology. We survey everything we see in place. And then we try to understand how the ship was constructed and why it went down. Hmm. And really get a catalog of some of the cultural materials that were taken down to the bottom. I mean, you can imagine they're like time capsules. What was aboard and what shipboard life was like, what people brought with them to work, because they worked on these vessels and sometimes lived there, really shows a period in time, a point in time when the ship sank. So it's really a fascinating career. I've been very blessed to have it. And it's very interesting. Fun to share.
I know that there are some conditions that are better for preserving archaeological artifacts and things like that. It seems like deserts are good because, you know, things are under sand and they're protected. What about water? What does water do to a wreck?
Well, in the Great Lakes, we don't have things they have in the ocean, like teredo worms and salt. Water breaks down things faster as well. So we have fresh water. It's low oxygen levels and dark. And so the sites are very, very well preserved. We do have invasive quagga mussels. So the zebra mussels, as we all know, have learned about, have really been outcompeted by the quaggas. And so now those completely cover the shipwrecks and completely cover the bottom. So we're ending up with a couple problems with those invasives, but we're really on a fast pace to try to catalog the metal wrecks before they degrade over time.
So there are obviously the big lakes, Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, but there are also thousands of other lakes in Wisconsin. And you've done a lot of work in the Yahara Lakes.
Yes.
What do you find at the bottom of them and place them for us in Wisconsin?
Sure. So the O'Hara Chain of Lakes is Madison-based, really. So we have four lakes. We have Mendota, Monona, Wabisa, and Keegansa. And they are, the objects that we see in them are very different than what we see on the Great Lakes. We're looking at, on the Great Lakes, mostly commercial vessels. Mm-hmm. And that's really where the focus of my work had been. And then very opportunistically, here in these lakes, we had a gentleman named Rick Krieger, and he was a radio technician for the city of Madison. He did 911 compliance to make sure that the fire and police departments could talk to each other on the radios and did installation in that. And when he retired, he decided to take up side scan sonaring, and he divided the lakes into small sections and then systematically started looking at what was on the bottom.
Wow.
So he gave me the opportunity to work with him and to go looking at what we call targets of opportunity. So these are things that look like cultural items. Sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. Sometimes they're a log. Sometimes it's, you know, a chair that drifted away or a piece of pier or something like that. And to really look at the different items that are on the bottom. So what we see here in the O'Hara Lakes are small fishing craft and things that would be lost off of someone's pier, but also dating back in time, we had a number of excursion vessels which were on our lakes, and so we see the remains of some of those as well. So, you know, the early days of sort of Madison tourism and going out on the lakes and going to places like Picnic Point by excursion vessel, or going over to, you know, Governor's Island, those would be done on these sort of smaller steamboats, and the remains of them are on the bottom, too.
Tamara Thompson is a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society and the Maritime Preservation and Archaeology Program there. And we're talking about what's on the bottom of the O'Hara Lakes system. And Tamara, I can only imagine that there is a huge range of things that you have found down there. Do you have some favorite finds?
Well, my favorite one is really a mistake. So sometimes we like to think that GPS coordinates are very, very accurate, and they can be, but also because of atmospheric disturbances and that, you can be off by a few feet or so, a few hundred feet in some cases. Rick put me on one of these targets, and we went out in the morning. It was in about 55 feet of water, and he said, I don't know what this is. It's a blob on the bottom. But he found it again on his sonar through a marker, and then I rolled overboard and went down to the bottom. 55 feet is relatively deep for the Madison Lakes, and went to the bottom, and I found a gas grill. And and so then he came back and says, there's another target that's not very far from here. So we went out and searched for it and came back around. He's like, it seems like it's not in the right place. But he says, here it is on the bottom, threw the marker in again. And you know what it was? It was the gas grill. So I got to dive on that gas grill twice. If it wasn't exciting enough the first time. So that's my favorite story of the
Madison
Lakes.
And you wonder how that gas grill got out there.
And in the middle of the lake.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I would like to think it fell off a pontoon boat and there was a real ruckus party going on. That would be fun.
I guess we'll never know, probably, unless someone hears this and says, yeah, hey, that's my gas grill. So I'm sure you, as you said, you find a lot of boats, watercrafts, but I'm guessing, having seen cars out on the lakes,
yeah,
for ice fishing, that maybe you found one or two of those.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't know what year it was prohibited for the driving on the ice. However, for many, many years, people did go out and access the ice for pleasure or also for ice fishing by car. And there's a notorious crack. I like to go ice boating, and so we know about this crack that runs between Fox Bluff and Picnic Point. And so there's always this huge ice ridge there now. And there was also, around the 1900s. And there are a few cars that are lost off of Fox Bluff, right where that crack is. And they're all in the same place. There's three of them that are on the bottom. And unfortunately, some of them are associated with some tragic deaths. But they are in pristine condition. Some of them are sitting upright on the bottom with the keys still in them.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing to come across these items on the bottom.
It has to be sometimes a little eerie, feeling like you really are seeing a snapshot of a moment when something went under.
Oh, absolutely. So, and to really connect with that and then try to go back and search through the newspaper archives and figure out if there was some sort of report or trace of this small boat on the bottom or this car or, you know, why there would be part of a wagon somewhere and try to piece that together. And we're still in the process of figuring it out. There's a number of mysteries that are still out there. And so there's always new things that Rick's finding. He hasn't completed his survey. So you never know what next year's going to bring.
What is the value of this type of archaeology? What can we learn? How does it inform, you know, other work?
The value of it really is that it tells our history. It's a snapshot of what was going on in a point in time. It tells about us as citizens of Madison how we might have taken garbage out on the ice to get it out of the cities and to keep the cities clean, and then it fell through the ice and there are these rubbish piles on the bottom. They're interesting. You can go through them and find a lot of really interesting finds if you like digging through garbage. But you know, that tells a little bit of our history. Or when you see these excursion vessels, we don't think about excursion vessels on the lake. Surely we see Betty Lou out there on occasion, the Grand Mariner. And we don't really think of this time where there was boat building here in Madison, and that they built these excursion vessels, and that was a business, and that was part of this sort of pleasure movement that was going on in our city, and it got people away from the cities. You know, the cities were dirty and maybe environmentally poor place to be, and so to go out into the countryside and have a picnic on Maple Bluff was certainly something, and it kind of connects you back to that little bit of history. So as far as value, like dollars and cents, I don't know how you could put a value on that. And I certainly don't think many of these items could be recovered after being on the bottom, but it certainly is a treasure.
Well, Tamara, thanks so much for sharing your passion with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That was Tamara Thompson. She's a maritime archaeologist with the Wisconsin Historical Society's Maritime Preservation and Archaeology Program. She joined us to talk about the interesting finds that are on the bottom of the Yahara Lakes.
Coming up after the news, are you able to walk where you want to go in your community? An expert on city planning tells us how cities, big and small, can do a lot to improve walkability. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farad.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, spouses who lose their partner are at a much higher risk of death in the 3 months after their loved one's death. We'll learn the best ways to reach out and support them.
First, think about the place you live or a place you like to visit. Is it a good place to go for a walk? Do you feel safe there as a pedestrian? Is there anywhere to walk to?
Walkability has emerged as a big trend in renting and real estate. The National Association of Realtors said last year that demand for walkable neighborhoods is increasing and changing the home selling industry.
But lots of cities and towns today are not very walkable. Our next guest says there are lots of ways to change that. Jeff Speck is a city planner and the head of the planning firm Speck & Associates. He wrote a how-to guide for making places more walkable. His new book is Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Rob.
You spend a lot of your book talking about how to make cities and other communities more walkable. You start off talking about why, and let's start there. Why is it in our benefit to have more walkable communities?
Well, it's interesting as a city planner and as someone who argued for making places more walkable for many years, and my mentors before me, mostly from a planning perspective and all the planning reasons and design reasons why it made sense to make places better designed, and seeing people not really caring all that much. And then what happened was about 15 years ago, there were these three other groups, the epidemiologists, the environmentalists, and the economists, who were all arguing from their playbooks about why we should be making more walkable places and getting a lot more traction, a lot more attention. In very brief, you know, the economics argument, there's a positive argument to be made about people, of course, paying more to be in more walkable places because they value them more. But the basic story of American development is that we, in 1970, we spent 10% of our income on transportation, and we just about doubled the number of roads in this country, and now we spend 20% of our income on transportation because we've tied ourselves to this extremely expensive way of getting around, which is, you know, dragging the car with us everywhere we go. The environmental argument is simple and easy. You know, the more we drive, the more we're contributing to climate change. And then the health argument, we have these doctors who are basically saying we need better planning because we've engineered out of existence the useful walk in our communities. And so people aren't getting the exercise they used to get. We have the first generation of kids in America who are expected to live shorter lives than their parents. And these doctors are saying it's because walking isn't something we do as a regular means of exercise every day just to get around. And there's a lot more depth to all those arguments, but those are three arguments that I highlight in my last book, which was called Walkable City. And since writing that, I've realized that there were two more, which are in this new book. And one is about community and how we find that in walkable places, community forms a lot more. You know your neighbors better. You participate more in community activities. And of course, the shorter your commute, the more you participate in clubs and sports and other things, pretty obviously. But the other is equity, and the story is kind of sad, but the people who are dying in car crashes the most, the people who are pedestrians who are being hit by cars the most, are definitely on the lower end of the spectrum. And people often talk about cycling, you know, even in a place like Madison, which is well known for its cycling, but they talk about cycling as being this elite thing, right, that's done by wealthier people. But in fact, the latest data shows that fully 39% of people who commute to work are from the lowest 25% of income earners. So there's a strong argument for improving your cycle network as well to support those who need more help.
When people think of city planning, they might think of a big city downtown, and that's part of your story. But you say we should be thinking about this in smaller communities and even suburban communities, areas we might think of as sprawl zones.
Well, the second to last of my 101 points in my book is don't give up on sprawl. And there's a lot to be said about how even the worst sprawl could be made a lot safer, or let's just say less deadly, by making the streets better designed than they currently are. But, you know, most Americans live near or in walking distance of some sort of town center or city center or main street or someplace where actually that walkable lifestyle is available to people who want to have it, if it's provided and if it's attainable. You know, I do most of my work in smaller cities, about the size of Madison or smaller, or bigger cities that aren't that well known for advanced, you know, planning. I work in Oklahoma City. I work in Davenport, Iowa. You know, I've worked near Madison. We could talk about that. But the, you know, these are the places where most Americans live. And if there's some little knuckle of what we call pre-war urbanism, if there's some part of your city which was built principally before the World Wars and has some traditional urbanism in it, a main street where the buildings are up against the sidewalk and not behind a parking lot, or, you know, smaller stores and not a Walmart, or at least away from the Walmart, then that's a place where you can, by reinforcing walkability, but also balancing the uses, by adding housing, which a lot of downtowns are doing, you can make a real 24/7 place where people actually have that urban lifestyle you might expect in a bigger city in a smaller community. And frankly, a lot of people prefer that. You know, a lot of people don't want to be in the big city, but they want all the benefits of a less car-dependent lifestyle.
Jeff Speck is with us. His new book is Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. A lot of your recommendations involve making walking feel and be safer. And a big part of it is speed kills. Talk about the difference between if cars are driving 25, 30, 40 miles an hour in a place where you want people walking.
It's a real geometric relationship that increases dramatically with speed. So a car going 35 miles an hour is about seven times as likely to kill you as a car going 25 miles an hour. And this is the cusp at which cars are driving, right, in your city, in your more downtown areas or your more potentially walkable areas. So the question is, what can you do to cause drivers to choose to go a speed which is safer and actually just choose to obey the speed limit? And the problem is that for years in our communities, the highway engineers were applying highway engineering techniques to our downtowns, to our main streets. And this is a shocker often to people who aren't in the business, but it's normal to engineer a street for about 10 miles an hour over the posted speed. And the idea is that it's forgiving, right? That if a driver goes too fast, they won't crash on it. But of course, what that technique does is it causes people to speed. So, I was working on a project in Alabama, and we were trying to make nice, calm streets. And the county engineer who was in charge said, but you can't have that tight little curve or you can't have that narrow street because we have to engineer it for 40 miles an hour. I said, but the speed limit's 25. He goes, yeah, but that's the speed which you have to engineer it for. There's this complete misunderstanding about the way that environment influences behavior in street design. And fortunately, that's being changed right now. But most communities have been built around this confusion. And all the things that cause you to drive slower are the things that often the highway engineers mitigate against. So, of course, we want to have small blocks, lots of intersections. We want to have parallel parking, which slows cars down and protects the curb. We want to have two-way traffic and not one-way traffic. Street trees, which were once termed FHOs, fixed hazardous objects, have actually been determined to cause drivers to go more slowly when they're near the road. Narrower lanes, there's lots of things that you can do to actually, and the Dutch did it about, 15 years ago and caused the number of pedestrian deaths to drop like almost to zero by basically saying we're going to engineer an environment in which drivers make the choice to drive slower.
It seems like when we talk about pedestrian safety, it's all about managing the pedestrian, making sure they cross when they're supposed to cross, where they're supposed to cross, that kind of thing. It sounds like you're saying, no, we can design safety. We can build it into the driving side of the equation.
Well, thank you for saying that, because, there's also a ton of pedestrian blaming that happens, and pedestrians being advised to wear bright clothing, buckets by the side of the road in Salt Lake City where you take out a flag that you're supposed to wave as you cross the street so you won't be plowed down. There's a lot of stuff that's done. And then this whole campaign now against texting while walking, right? Which, of course, I've walked into a lamppost once doing that. But the fact is that it's principally the driver's behavior and I would say the engineer's behavior that's leading to the dangerous circumstances in our communities. And what's frustrating is we know how to fix it. But it's a very uphill battle in many communities to get the local public works engineer to allow you to do that.
We're talking to Jeff Speck, author of the book Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places.
And we want to hear from you. How important is it to you to be able to walk to the store, to church, maybe to your children's school, or even your workplace? Have you ever lived somewhere that was very walkable? Or have you ever chosen where to live based at least in part on that? Would you be willing to cut down on how much you drive if more was within walking distance? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Boisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about how to make communities more walkable. Jeff Speck is a city planner with Speck & Associates. He's with us to talk about his latest book, Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places.
And what do you think? Is walkability something you want where you live? Do you have a local school or park within a five-minute walk from you? Is housing affordable and livable? If you could put one thing in your neighborhood to be closer to you, what would it be? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
To your calls now, Mary is with us in Stevens Point. Mary, hi.
Hi. I'm on the Common Council in Stevens Point, and we've got one urban planner on our Common Council and people who are highly educated about street design and bike ped issues. So we've done a lot. We the county has a bike ped plan that the city adopted. Two of our residents wrote a TAP grant, so we've got a grant for restriping a large number of city streets. We have a bike ped committee now that reports to Common Council, and we're instituting a 4-to-3 lane conversion on one heavily traveled four-lane road. But I also want to tie this in with your previous guest. We've had a whole lot of very vocal community pushback against these efforts that make our streets better for everybody. Horrible social media comments, rage shown at city meetings, and it's been daunting. But we've got a supportive city staff, and the mayor is supportive of our efforts. So we're getting things done on Stevens Point. It's already flat, and now we're making it even better.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff, your thoughts on hearing what Mary had to say in Stevens Point?
Well, it's what we call the bike lash, you know, when you try to add bicycle facilities and other stuff to a community or otherwise make it safer. And, it, you know, people, in my experience, it's not that hard to get to improve the pedestrian experience. But when you try to take any part of a roadway and recommit it to cycling, that's when you really get into the, you know, the different political stripes and people showing their, sometimes their worst side. I had a very funny experience. I was wondering if I would tell this story, but this is a perfect setup, which is that the last time I was on the radio in Madison, I was called on to be an expert because someone was considering a 4-to-3 conversion, which the caller mentioned, on a street heading north out of the city. This is what's called the classic American road diet, where you take a four-lane road, which is inherently very dangerous and also very inefficient because the fast lane is also the turning lane, and you turn it into a three-lane road. There's been many dozens of these done around the U.S., and they improve safety dramatically, you know, with a center turn lane that's shared, and they do not reduce the capacity of the street for cars. They handle just as many cars after as before, and what you can do with that extra 10 or 11 feet you get by eliminating a lane is put in two bike lanes or add parking or do something else. In this case, they were adding bike lanes. And the experience of these streets is that you know, they handle just as many cars as before. The merchants do just as well or usually better along the street. And I was asked to come on the air because a city councilor in Madison who also happened to own a restaurant on that street was the biggest opponent of the conversion. And so they asked me to opine on whether these 4-to-3 road diets worked. And I said, you know, I don't have an opinion. I have evidence. And I listed the evidence. And I gave all the reasons that I just gave you and some more. And then they said, okay, and now for the counter opinion, let's speak to the city councilor. And he had hung up. He had just stormed away from the telephone because he didn't hear what he wanted to hear. But, you know, there's a number of kind of easy, quick fixes that you can do. And the caller mentioned restriping, you know, which is so much cheaper than rebuilding a street. Just reallocate the pavement that you have in a way that makes people drive more safely. And I'm always looking for those streets in a community that aren't congested, you know, that have too many lanes, more lanes than they need. And that's a great opportunity to convert asphalt from driving or speeding into parking or into cycling or maybe into a parklet that broadens the sidewalk so you can do sidewalk dining or something like that.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Lisa in Janesville. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I am just wondering, after having lived in England for a few years and enjoying being able to walk anywhere that I wanted to in a city that I lived in that was about 25,000 people, now coming back to the U.S., and I really miss that, I'm wondering if you have looked at any of the designs of the layouts of the cities, which I know were built many, many years ago, but incorporating some of those designs into any cities currently in the U.S.
Well, I haven't switched any of the driving to the other side of the street
good,
to make
good.
It more British, but I think that there's a number of things that, let me just start over. The things that make British cities safer than most American cities have nothing to do with the historic nature. If you're looking at, you know, older American cities versus British cities, if you're looking at newer American cities, you might as well compare them to places like Madison and Milwaukee or the older towns. The real distinction is new versus old. And what did the country do in the last 50 years? The difference between the U.S. and England isn't principally that they're older, but that their last 50 years of road design has been much more pedestrian and cycling oriented and much less automotive oriented. Simply around, for example, how wide the driving lanes are, which sounds like getting in the weeds, but it's super important because the lane width determines how fast people drive. You know, how narrow the right of way is, whether there are street trees, and honestly, they haven't had the same destruction of their city centers from big box stores in England that we've had in the U.S. That's had a huge impact on the walkability of our smaller towns. They've had some, but not as much. So it's really not the historic nature of England that makes it a more walkable place. It's the mistakes that we've made over the past 50 years.
Lisa, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Jeff Speck. His new book is Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. We heard from Chris in Horicon. Chris says he's a truck driver. He's worried about narrowing streets when he's delivering into these maybe more walkable pedestrian areas. The narrow streets, he says, make his job more difficult and unsafe. Is there a loss there for making streets narrower when businesses need these deliveries coming in?
Well, you need to make sure that the streets, and particularly the intersections, are designed so that the trucks that are using them can maneuver, unless it's the wrong truck. And there are some places where you need to put in rules about truck size. But in most of America, you know, it's pretty large trucks. And you need to make sure they can maneuver. But actually, with due respect to Chris, I would say that the things that he thinks make his job more dangerous are actually causing him and everyone else to drive the proper speed. And tightening his roadway in a way that his truck still fits, but fits at 20 miles an hour and not comfortably at 30, is exactly what we need to do to make us safer while we make his job slightly harder. And that's a sacrifice I would ask him to make.
We've been focusing on safety. Let's talk about desirability and attractiveness. You have some suggestions. Some of your rules are things like, you got a parking garage, don't have it fronting right up on the sidewalk, because who wants to walk block after block of parking garage? What sorts of things can we think about to make walking attractive?
So the word I use isn't attractive, because that kind of implies a certain subjective angle.
Sure.
But I just say interesting. So people will only walk if the walk is useful, safe, comfortable, and interesting. Useful has to do with having different uses around you, so you're just not in a single-use subdivision, right? Safe, we talked about. Comfortable and interesting have to do with shaping street spaces so that they hold you nicely. We talk about outdoor living rooms when you're a planner, so having good edges and good spaces. But then, are those spaces interesting? Do they show signs of human habitation or human presence? Or are they boring? Are they blank walls? Are they parking decks? That sort of thing. Now, if you go around the U.S., certain communities have rules, for example, about building a parking deck. Do you have to put retail on the ground floor of that parking deck and give it a higher ceiling so the retail works if you're in a retail area? That's a rule some cities have. Or a more versatile rule, do you have to set the parking deck back at least 20 feet from the sidewalk edge and then build something like housing between it and the street? And more cities, I wouldn't be surprised if it's happened in Madison, more and more cities like that I work in, like Des Moines, have one or several examples of massive parking decks that you can't even see from the sidewalk because there's a thin liner of residential building between it and the curb. And you can kind of judge a city by whether it has these, you know, if a city's of significant size and it doesn't have these rules, then it's not focused on the attractiveness of its public realm.
We haven't even really touched zoning, and we won't have time for that, I guess, Jeff. But as
good.
We wrap
zoning's
up,
very boring.
Well, but important. But as we wrap up, are people, you mentioned different stakeholders are now getting on board with this. Are people, as you go from city to city, more and more buying what you're selling about walkability?
I've been doing this for about 20, 25 years, and I've seen a very dramatic change in what was originally a minority opinion. And now I think most people want what we are advocating for, but you know there are a lot of people whose feeling about a downtown or whose relationship to their downtown is to zip in and zip out, and they don't really set foot on it while they're there. Maybe they drive through it to get somewhere else. And they're always, you know, if their focus is their own self-interest, they're always going to want driving speed more than they're going to want, you know, a great place. And we always say, you know, you have a choice. You can be a place that's easy to get through or a place that's worth arriving at. And one would hope that even the suburbanites among us would care enough about having a center worth admiring to make a little bit of a sacrifice in their vehicle speed to gain that benefit.
It's a good place to leave it. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it was my pleasure. Thanks for listening.
That was Jeff Speck, a city planner with Speck and Associates. He was with us to talk about his latest book, Walkable City Rules, 101 Steps to Making Better Places. If you picture someone bird watching, you might think of somebody out in a field or a forest with some binoculars, maybe a notebook and a field guide.
But you can add someone sitting in a coffee shop or on their couch with their computer to that image.
It turns out that the Google Street View feature is being used by some naturalists to go birding around the world.
When a serious birder named Nicholas Lund found out about Google Street View in the late 2000s, he did what many of us do. He looked at his house to see what it looked like when the photo was taken and, you know, whether he happened to be in the image. But unlike the rest of us, he decided to combine that feature with his passion for birding.
At first, it was just him, until he created the Google Street View Birding Facebook group. Within a few weeks, hundreds of people joined the group and started combing through Google Street Views from around the world.
Birding can be hit or miss under normal circumstances, so it's hard to imagine finding any birds on Google Street View when it's literally one snapshot in time. But so far, the community has identified more than 580 different species, which is about 5% of all bird species on Earth.
I'm sure I'd be just as successful identifying birds online as I am in person. Well, like 0%, unless like it's like an eagle or something.
Well, it's funny because they actually say it's the exact same thing as when you're out in the field and you think, what is that gray blob? Is it this or that? But I think it's actually really cool because people who don't have a lot of mobility can do it.
All right. Sounds fun. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.